The social media tools in the past provide sometimes questionable content, and they provide it through mechanisms that make it really hard for the kids to resist it. Functionally addictive, they're consuming huge volumes of stuff that's not necessarily great for them. And the combination of those two factors has created an awful lot of harm. With AI, if you're engaged with a chatbot, you know, it gets extremely personalized very quickly. Kids are psychologically just much more affected by the emotional responses that may arise there.
Welcome back to the Regulating AI Podcast, the show where we bring the world's most consequential voices to the table to shape the future of responsible AI governance. I'm your host, Sanjay Puri, and today we have a guest who may be the only person on the planet who has prosecuted child sex traffickers, sued both Google and Ticketmaster, argued a case to the U.S. Supreme Court, and is now one of the most consequential voices in American AI policy. He grew up in Mystic, Connecticut, yes, the home of the Mystic Pizza, studied philosophy, politics, and economics at Oxford, earned his law degree at Harvard, and then spent nearly a decade putting away bad guys in Memphis, Tennessee. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome the Attorney General of Tennessee, Jonathan Scrimeti. Jonathan, welcome to the Regulating AI Podcast. Yes.
Thanks for having me, Sanjay.
Absolutely. Jonathan, we have a global audience. These are generally your peers in many cases in the U.S. We have members of Congress, we have think tanks, AI entrepreneurs, AGs, and others who watch us. But I generally do this to help our audience, sometimes who might not be as familiar, and you'd be surprised how many. One thing it would help is just very briefly tell them what the AG does.
So the attorney generals for each state are the chief legal officers for the state. And the portfolio varies from state to state based on different state constitutions, different state laws. But the broad gist of it in this area is we are the consumer protection advocates for the state. So we have enforcement authority, civil enforcement authority over unfair and deceptive trade practice laws, over antitrust laws, often over data privacy laws. And our job is, among other things, to protect consumers, to lessen the asymmetry between powerful corporations and individual consumers, such that the consumers aren't taken advantage of. They can have faith that markets work, that they can spend money and get what they expect, and overall just provide the basic enforcement infrastructure to keep markets working.
Well, that's very, very helpful, Jonathan. Well, there are a lot of big stories in AI, but one of the big stories in artificial intelligence, especially in AI policy, has been this issue about the administration wanting to preempt state legislation on AI. You led 40 attorney generals from both parties in opposing what you called a really genuinely scary federal attempt to ban state AI regulation for 10 years. Walk our audience through to what was actually proposed and why did you mobilize so quickly?
Well, it was a fast-moving issue. It came up several times, but originally it was attached to a fast-moving budget bill. And the language shifted a little bit over time. Originally, it was just a broad, flat moratorium. It started to focus more on eliminating specific state laws dealing with AI, but there was still some residual risk that our overall enforcement authority would be inhibited or even eliminated for 10 years, meaning we were worried we couldn't enforce basic consumer protection laws, such as you have to tell the truth about your product. And it was moving very quickly. It's particularly dangerous for two reasons. The first is there is no real federal enforcement mechanism. There's no federal legislation in place. So if the states weren't given the ability to regulate, there would be a complete vacuum. It's one thing to displace state policies with a uniform federal policy. It's another thing to just say, we will have no laws in this area for 10 years. It's absolute free rein for the companies to innovate however they want without any worry about the consequences. The second reason it was particularly scary is because AI is extraordinarily powerful technology. We have very strong indications that it will have transformative effects on our society in ways that we somewhat can anticipate, but there are a lot of unknowns there. The ability of AI to personalize its interactions. I mean, we've seen problems with chatbots, especially where kids are involved, where there's just an incredible risk of things going wrong. And with other technologies, you know, there are risks, but usually they happen more slowly. It's a result of using them too much, of addiction-like impacts or, you know, big structural concerns. With AI, the risk is very personalized, very individualized, and there's still a lot that we don't understand because innovation is happening so quickly. So if this was a regulatory desert and people could do whatever they wanted, one hopes that there would be a lot of positive innovation, but it would almost certainly come with really significant consequences for users. And there has to be some mechanism for accountability there.
So there were two main reasons, Jonathan, because, Jonathan, your constitutional home is federalism and the 10th Amendment. Is that fair to say? But AI systems, obviously, they don't respect borders. A model trained in California or wherever it is can operate seamlessly in, you know, in Tennessee. How do you balance strict federalism with the genuine borderless nature of AI technology?
So in terms of regulation, I'm really concerned about state micromanagement of the AI industry. I think it's a mistake to try to tell the companies how to run their businesses, how to administer their technology. We can look at impacts. We can look at kids being hurt as a result of the technology and set guardrails saying, don't release a product that does this or there will be consequences. But in terms of micromanaging how models are trained, for example, we're not very well equipped for that. And there are real problems if you have 50 different enforcement mechanisms out there. So I think this is an area where there probably is good argument for federal preemption in terms of drawing the regulatory boundaries. We have some laws of general application at the state level, really basic consumer protection laws saying you can't lie about your products to consumers. If your product is hurting consumers, you know, that's legally a problem for you. You need to stop or at least warn people. We also have antitrust laws to ensure that there's robust competition. These are laws that are going to apply in any event. So even if we're not micro-regulating the nature of AI products, we can still protect our consumers by using the same laws that we have in every other respect. But because we have this utter vacuum at the federal level right now, and I know Senator Blackburn and some of her colleagues are working hard to fill that void, but until they do, because there's essentially nothing there, the states are the only game in town. They are the only line of defense against bad actors in the AI industry. And so until we have a federal regulatory scheme that justifies preemption, you know, the states need to be able to exercise their authority to protect consumers. And, you know, I have real concerns. Obviously, my purview does not include national security. You know, the federal government is concerned with all of the external facing stuff. But the consequences of AI are such that we need to be really careful when we regulate it, not to kneecap the American AI industry at the expense of not just our economy, but our ability to protect American interests in the world. And I do worry that if the states get too excited about telling the companies exactly what they should be doing, we run a real risk of hurting the industry. So it's a tough balancing act.
Yeah, it is a real tough balancing act. And I think what I'm hearing from you, and I've had, you know, members of Congress who argued on federal preemption. We've had AGs who've talked about the states' rights, that states are the crucible of all legislation. What I hear from you, if there was something in the federal level, then maybe states would not have had to act with such speed and things like that. One question, Jonathan, I have is, let's just take, there is a small entrepreneur in Memphis, you know, in a garage somewhere, you know, working on some AI tools. I mean, if they have to deal with 10, 15 state laws, you know, California right now, Colorado is up, you know, several other places, is he or she in Memphis at a disadvantage versus, let's say, these big five, six, seven companies who have huge, well, you're a lawyer, I mean, who have got the means to, you know, deal with some of these things? Does that worry you a little bit?
Absolutely. You know, the more onerous the compliance, the more you lock in these titanic companies. I mean, we're dealing with, I think it's fair to say, probably the most powerful companies in the history of the world. They have resources on a state level. If you litigate against them, you're not facing an army of attorneys. You're facing an army of law firms. They have functionally infinite resources to deal with regulatory and legal issues. And so if they're trying to crank up the regulatory burden, it absolutely limits the ability of other people to compete. And so if the states are saying something like, if you know or should know that you're dealing with a child, then you have to make sure you're not subjecting them to sexually explicit material, that's a relatively easy guideline. The more onerous the state governance of what happens inside the technology becomes, the dramatically more difficult it becomes for anybody to keep up. So I don't know that we need a full-on regulatory sandbox, but I think the states need to be very cautious about just how far they're going in trying to tell these companies what to do. But we do need to provide bright lines to protect people and to let the companies know what they shouldn't do in advance so they're not surprised down the road.
Yeah, and I think, Jonathan, this is hopefully some of our members of Congress and Senate who are listening and is a little gentle nudge that they need to get their act together too, because a lot of them come on our show and a lot of them listen to the show. Jonathan, shifting from federal state to, let's go to another topic where you really have also taken a lead on, or I don't know about the lead, but at least you've been involved on, which was you joined the DOJ's landmark Real Page and AgriStats algorithmic antitrust case. And the Real Page case, and, you know, obviously we need to, you know, have you explain to our audience, basically was asking a fundamental question. And this is a unique twist. Can an algorithm be the mechanism of an illegal cartel? And you joined DOJ's lawsuit alleging that the AI pricing algorithm enabled landlords to collude on rents without ever sitting in the same room. Walk our audience through that legal theory, because if that succeeds, what does it mean for any AI system that makes pricing recommendations, whether it's for insurance, real estate, healthcare, airlines, et cetera?
So first of all, I love talking about these cases. I think they're really important because there is tremendous risk going forward. In RealPage, you had one algorithm consolidating pricing and supply information from a huge chunk of the market, quite a few rental companies were aggregating their information. If they had done this in a hotel room on a whiteboard, the FBI would have kicked the door in and arrested everybody. But they were doing it through a black box algorithm. And we had testimonials from people with some of these property management companies literally saying things like, boy, this is a great product. We make so much more money when we don't have to compete with each other. So it's the heart of why we have antitrust laws. We want to ensure that consumers are getting the benefits of market competition, and where companies are able to use new technology to commit the same crimes that they used to or violate the same rights that they used to using different means. We need to make sure that the application of the law keeps pace with the technology. And so, you know, the number one thing that I think we need to do with this and in the AgriStats case are put bright lines up to make it very clear that collusion through technology is the same as collusion through any other means. And consumers should not be exploited through this shortcut around the law. But if I'm in a position where I'm aggregating information like this, you know, I think if I'm going to have proprietary information from a variety of competing companies, there has to be some sort of very explicit safeguard or some sort of a radical transparency. Smarter minds than me will come up with solutions, I think. But, you know, one way or another, it can't be a collection of powerful companies sharing information and then using that information to keep prices inflated. There has to be some check there. And right now, the most basic check is to just say you're not allowed to do this.
And what you're saying is whether you do it in person or you do it in algorithms, it's still a violation of law. So, Jonathan, just a couple of questions on this. Technology is moving so fast. Are we equipped, when I say equipped, whether it's the AG's office, DOJ, FTC, all the relevant agencies, to deal with something like this? Because you kind of identified RealPage and AgriStats. Maybe there are other things that we might not even be aware of.
That's true. And you know, I used to be an adjunct professor of cyber law years ago. And the number one lesson I always tried to impart to the students was the law will never keep pace with technology. There will always be a delay there. And at best, you're scrambling to keep up. But there are real harms that happen as a result of that gap. I think it's really important to establish the principle. And at least that way, if companies are going to engage in this conduct, they have fair warning that it's against the law. And I also think it's dangerous for us to try to get too granular about the principles. You know, I should not be telling companies how to construct algorithms because they're much better at that than I am. But I can tell them if you take information that will, through the sharing, increase prices at the expense of consumers, that creates liability for you. That's a basic legal principle to let them then make informed decisions about what they do. And if there are consequences as a result of their bad actions, they were warned, there's a bright line that they crossed, and they knew it in advance. So I think it's great that we have these cases as an opportunity to assert that principle, because there is a lot of innovation going on and people need to understand the potential consequences.
So Jonathan, do you think because of the pace of technology that the role of the AG also starts shifting and changing, because, or even the staff that you have, even DOJ or FTC, because, you know, now you're dealing with a lot of digital and AI related stuff that you probably never dealt with before. I'm just thinking because this RealPage and AgriStats is really an eye opener in many ways.
I think it does dramatically change the nature of the job. You know, we're seeing a few things. Federal capacity is largely reduced. I mean, the DOJ is not taking on as many things as it used to. And the FTC is working hard, but it's just one agency and it doesn't have all the tools that the AGs do. Historically, the AGs are the primary enforcers of consumer protection laws. DOJ traditionally was the primary antitrust enforcer. I think they remain that, but the balance is shifting on that front. And then the AGs are increasing capacity and doing more and more work, you know, on multi-state consumer protection, where it's certainly a national issue. But because we have collectively more capacity and we often have more leverage because of the laws that we have, we're the ones out front enforcing. So we need to better understand what we're doing. I worry sometimes the political incentives may create some great headlines in the short term, but may adversely affect our economy, the well-being of consumers, innovation, even national security in the long run, if we're not really thoughtful about what we enforce and how we enforce it. So the AG's offices and the AG community are working hard to understand these issues better. We're trying to bring in people who are more interested and more educated on these issues. I think everybody has seen an increase in data privacy practice. We're ramping up our consumer protection and antitrust work here in Tennessee. So there's a recognition that because everybody is so accessible at all times to all these different companies by virtue of carrying around the internet in their pocket, there's just more opportunity for consumer harm. And we need to be able to keep the pace with that in a very thoughtful way.
Just one minor small point on this and we'll move on. Do you think maybe there can be some collaboration with these foundation companies in saying, hey, help, you know, you guys produce such incredible tools to do for healthcare innovation, for education, for manufacturing, for cybersecurity. Give us some tools so we can detect some of these things, because, I mean, it's in their interest too. I mean, is that maybe a conversation, Jonathan? Because some of those folks listen to this podcast too. So I'm saying, is that maybe that can also be a conversation that can be had?
Absolutely. You know, we're trying to figure out all the optimal ways to integrate AI products into the work that we do. It's slow going because we have some concerns that private entities don't. But in the long run, if we're not able to integrate AI tools to detect bad conduct, to help us optimize the work that each employee does, we're not going to be able to keep up. So we need to make sure we're moving quickly on that front.
Great. Jonathan, moving from that, let's talk about another area that you've really been leading that effort. You have, you know, said that basically AI tools present threats to kids that are more immediate, more personal, and more dangerous than any prior technology. You know, we have a lot of parents that are listening in our audience. Can you just make that a little concrete? What does AI-enabled harm to children actually look like that maybe is a little different than what, let's say, Instagram, TikTok, or any of these other social media tools have done?
The social media tools in the past provide sometimes questionable content, and they provide it through mechanisms that make it really hard for the kids to resist it. So it's functionally addictive. They're consuming huge volumes of stuff that's not necessarily great for them. And the combination of those two factors has created an awful lot of harm. I think just the structural design issues are the biggest problem there. But with AI, you add additional layers, and that is the responsiveness to the user. So, you know, the algorithms, the YouTube algorithm is incredible at feeding you what you want and keeping you engaged, but it's still feeding you content that's produced beforehand. And there's a passive relationship there in terms of receiving the content. With AI, if you're engaged with a chatbot, you know, it gets extremely personalized very quickly. Kids are psychologically just much more affected by the emotional responses that may arise there. And so if you have a chatbot that's designed to optimize engagement without any necessarily intentional harm involved, you know, we've seen incidents where kids who start going in a bad direction with a chatbot, whether it's towards self-harm, towards harming others, just see a magnification there as the algorithm keeps feeding them negative stimulus in ways that are tailored to provoke additional reactions. And so there's a feedback loop there that's just much stronger, much more effective, much more immediate than you get from a less personalized technology.
Yeah, so just to follow up on that, Jonathan, in May of last year, you had demanded answers from Meta about its AI chatbot, which allowed adults to basically simulate the sexual grooming of children. Meta had apparently, it seemed, built this capability in there. What does that tell you about the governance culture inside some of the large AI companies right now?
It's a problem. You know, the technology is moving fast. You get people who are so excited about innovation that they're not paying attention to some basic principles of caution. I mean, the GCs ought to be there waving flags saying, if you're coming up with policies for how our technology will interact with children, be careful. Because Meta had some internal policy documents that were an attempt to put up guidelines for how to deal with kids interacting with Meta chatbots. But the rule was basically, you know, you can't provide explicit sexual content to kids, but you can provide sexualized content to a certain degree to kids as young as 8. And the reaction of every AG that saw that was, you know, we need to stop these guys. And I thought it was good to be able to send a letter rather than just file a lawsuit. Because the companies are doing a lot of good. We need them to succeed, but they need to know that if their products are hurting kids, there will be significant consequences. And if their products are interacting with children and they're aware of risks, they need to take steps to mitigate that before it becomes a big problem. we as enforcers collectively really drop the ball with social media, the potential harms here are dramatically greater. And so we need to tell the companies up front, make sure that you are not taking steps to hurt kids. And I recognize as these algorithms develop, the companies are still understanding consequences. We're still understanding how people interact with this technology. New products are coming along all the time. We have to be cognizant of that. And so there may be algorithmic hiccups that are really bad that need to be addressed. That's different than having policies that say it's okay to do these bad and prohibited things. So the companies need to adopt the right policies so they draw internal guardrails to protect them from the external guardrails that will be imposed on them. And they need to have the right orientation. I know Senator Blackburn has legislation that would impose a duty of care on AI companies dealing with children. And I think that's the right approach. Rather than having the government try to micromanage the technology, we just need to impose the appropriate duty and say, if you are trusted with the attention of children, with their intellects, with what they're going to experience, you need to be thoughtful. You need to treat them the way you would treat your own child, and make sure that they are benefiting from this technology rather than being subjected to it. And so changing the mindset internally is the most effective thing we can do. And it's the least headline worthy from an AG perspective. It's the least likely to get us substantial litigation windfall. But the goal is not for us to make money or get attention. It's to protect kids. And the best way to protect kids is to tell the companies at the front end, you better make sure that you're making good decisions. And when you get feedback from your products that there's harm to children, you need to address that immediately and not, you know, continue to proceed without regard for the impact of your product on its users.
Yeah. So as you said, you want these companies to succeed. You're not looking for headlines. But so let's talk about you let the 44 state AGs in endorsing the Child Exploitation and AI Expert Commission Act. So what specifically do the AGs want the commission to produce, and what enforcement mechanism should follow? Because, yes, you're going to write letters and you want self-governance by these companies, but let's just say if that doesn't happen, then what, Jonathan?
Well, with the commission, I think the primary goal of that was to look at AI interactions with child sexual abuse material. And you've got a couple of different issues there. The nudify apps that can take pictures of actual children and create naked images are you just the basement. Like, those should be super illegal, and there should be aggressive prosecution of people who put those out. The app stores should be held accountable if any of that technology is available through the app stores. I mean, we just need to shut down the distribution channels there. And be extremely aggressive about that. In terms of fake children, AI-generated children, if there's child sexual abuse material involving fake children, there are some constitutional issues there. I think they're ripe for additional litigation. And I think there needs to be an opportunity to pursue those cases as well. So I think the big outcome that we'd like from the commission is just clarity on exactly how these products should be defined, clarity on what federal law should say to ensure that kids are protected without regard for jurisdiction, enforcement tools to make sure that we're able to have some agency that can track down the people that are doing this, and, you know, resources there to make sure that it's getting done. I mean, because of the jurisdictional issues, this really is a federal concern as well as a state concern. You're probably looking at an international component in addition to an interstate component. And, you know, it's an area where the AGs care deeply, but we're not necessarily equipped by law or by resources to deal with it effectively. So we want to make sure that we're promoting appropriate federal responses to protect our kids.
Yeah. Jonathan, you know, at the federal level, there has been this conversation that's going on a bipartisan basis. You know, we have this law where if someone puts objectionable content on the site, the site holder is not liable. I think it's called Section 203 or in that nature. Do you think, now because it's now been in practice for a long period of time, that with the passage of time, do you think some modifications are needed for some a legislation like that?
Yeah, I think Section 230 was a great innovation. Great, like the pinnacle of free speech culture. Correct. It protected the early internet so that you could run a robust conversation on your message board and you wouldn't be liable for the dumb things that users said. Technology has changed a great deal. And I think it's important to keep the core speech protections there. But if you're looking at technology that's producing objectionable content, or if you're looking at inherently objectionable content, there should be increased enforcement. You know, I think a lot of the big platforms have done a pretty good job taking down offensive material, illegal material very quickly and working with law enforcement. We need to continue to encourage that. But, you know, as you go from passive message board where you're just providing a forum where people can post to an algorithmically driven platform where you're picking what material to promote and what material different people will have access to, you know, the AI frontier where you're generating material in response to user prompts, there's more and more onus on the companies because they're more and more responsible for what people see. It's not just a matter of throwing open the door to the forum and saying, everybody come in here and say what you want to say. So the companies have put themselves in a position where they're more responsible for the material that's being distributed. The law needs to reflect that. I think the actual text of Section 230 interpreted properly may be fine, but we've seen some pretty broad interpretations. We've seen some very aggressive litigation by the platforms to push the boundaries there. And I think if we don't have a 230 that is narrowly constrained to protect speech and is instead a source of immunity for the entire industry, then we do need to look at an alternative.
Okay. You had Jonathan Haidt's The Anxious Generation was cited by you as an inspiration for your work. Today you have, and you mentioned this, AI tutors, AI companions, AI therapists are kind of entering children's lives. And you touched on these. Should there be some kind of an age criteria? We've seen the harm some of these chatbots and have done, and there are some cases that are working their way in the system per se. And do these things concern you? And we've talked about obviously social media versus this. What are your thoughts on this?
So I think there needs to be a distinction between young children and teenagers and adults using these technologies, and there should be stricter and stricter guardrails. I know some people are talking about a ban on chatbots for children. I'm a little bit hesitant about that because I think there's big potential upside. One of my favorite books is Neal Stephenson's The Diamond Age, and there's an AI chatbot in that that takes a very underprivileged child, and because she has access to this resource, she's able to get an incredible education hyper-efficiently. And I think that's the promise of AI. There's so much good that can be done. And so I don't want to completely slam the door for this generation of kids on enjoying those benefits, but we have to be really, really careful. There has to be transparency. We have to have companies that are closely monitoring the impact on kids. We have to have limits on the material that they can see, potentially limits on the amount of time they can spend. I mean, I think we need to be really creative in setting guardrails to avoid any really systemic harms to users. But I also think that we need to be attentive to the potential benefits. And, you know, you hear about Alpha School where they're using AI to apparently incredible effect on standardized test scores. You know, you don't want to cut that off. So I think the nature of the products, I think the nature of the oversight of the children's use of the products is really important. I've also heard from some victim services providers that there are chatbots that are really beneficial to kids who have dealt with traumatic events, mass shootings, and similar horrific circumstances where interaction with the chatbot may be a valuable part of the overall course of treatment. So we don't need to be Luddites about this, but we also have to recognize that all those potential benefits, if the technology is misdirected or if inattentive companies just make it too broadly available, can have severe consequences. We've heard the suicide stories. We've seen evidence of AI encouragement of homicides. These are very smart companies with incredible talent pools. They need to be cognizant of the social impact of the technology as they're developing it, because ultimately they're in the best position to limit the harm.
Yeah. Let's shift to a little more forward-looking topics. Jonathan, agentic AI is the kind of the topic du jour these days, and these systems can now browse the web, they can execute code, make purchases, make your travel bookings, negotiate contracts autonomously. No legal statute was kind of written with this in mind. You obviously, as you mentioned, taught cyber law, and which covers the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, the Stored Communication Act also. Where does the current legal framework actually allow these systems to do, and where does it break down? Can you just tell our listeners a little bit about that?
I think contract law is driving a lot of what's possible now. I'll be honest, agentic AI is super interesting. There is so much about it, so many ramifications there that I know I'm not conscious enough of. And so I worry about consumers. I worry, for instance, about companies using their own agents to give people who aren't similarly equipped the runaround. It's the asymmetry that's the real risk on that front, where if somebody's just eating up time, if there's a customer service chatbot that's really good at frustrating people in subtle ways so that they're not claiming their refunds, you know, that's a benefit to the company through the abuse of an AI product. The possibilities are pretty grand, and I think we'll have to look at the statutes, but I don't understand it enough to know what the new statutes would have to look like, or even broad strokes, where the biggest concerns are going to be in a year or two as more and more people adopt these. The one thing I know is we better get up to speed, because I'm certain we're going to see more and more complaints. But this is another area where the potential upsides are just infinite. And so we need to make sure that as the complaints come in, as we start to see the deficiencies of existing products, we don't accidentally kill the golden goose.
Yeah. Just briefly shifting a little globally, you know, the EU has the EU AI Act, the UK has their own safety consortium, Canada, Singapore, they've developed comprehensive AI regulatory frameworks. You obviously, you know, you look at Tennessee and your protection, and within the AG's consortium, you know, you look across all of you across different states. Do the AGs have any kind of communication with foreign jurisdictions in terms of what they are doing? If there's something you can, when I say you, the AGs can learn from them, or they can learn from us?
Very little. We have a little bit of international interaction, and I know certain states have their own relationships with international regulators. I would note, and I hope this isn't too chauvinistic, that there are some really onerous safety regulations in place in countries that don't have the AI innovation that America has. And so I think we need to be really careful about looking abroad for what we want to do regulatorily, because I think our approach, deficient as it has been, is still the better approach. And we need to refine what we have as opposed to adopting something that's much more comprehensive and robust. I hope that's not.
No, that's why I said, have they come to you looking to learn from you also? That's why I said that.
No. I mean, our interaction with foreign regulators is almost always us looking to what they're doing. You know, on the competition side, there's often overlap on the more consumer oriented regulation. It's a lot more attenuated.
Sounds good. In 2019, you had identified transparency as the state's top AI priority in a speech I think you gave to NCSL Cybersecurity Task Force. now basically we are in this age of AI, and some of the biggest AI, you know, powerful models are basically opaque. I mean, when you feed some things into any of these models, how do you know how they will come up with the answer? Yes, you know, you have, you know, how they kind of put these things out there. But does that concern you in terms of the opaqueness of some of these models?
To some extent, yes. I think there's room for transparency without necessarily delving into the secret sauce of each model, though. I mean, if you look at what the training data is, if there's transparency in terms of known harms, you know, there are different metrics you can look at for usage that potentially indicate areas of concern. I think you can have a pretty transparent regime without getting into trade secrets and architecture. So, maybe I'm naive about that, but I think there's a lot of opportunity. You know, and the other thing is in interactions, as the technology becomes more and more embedded in day-to-day life, simply having chatbots identify themselves, I think would be useful. You know, there are some therapeutic AIs that say, I'm a licensed therapist. Well, no, they're not. No, they're not. It's a machine. And so just being transparent about the fact that you're not speaking to a human being is important to let people make informed decisions. Doesn't mean the chatbot's not adding value to your life, but I think it's an important part of understanding the nature of the interaction when you know that you're speaking to an algorithm.
Sounds good. Finally, Jonathan, you've been involved in the state federal moratorium issues. You obviously worked on the algorithmic antitrust issue and obviously protected children on multiple fronts. Is there any AI governance issue that still concerns you that the public should know about or our listeners should know about?
The thing that I'm the most concerned about in the long run is, I don't know if it's still called emotional AI, but just the ability of algorithms to gather incredible amounts of data. You know, everything from personal histories to micro expressions and vocal indicators to just really identify psychological weaknesses or provoke them. You know, if you want to make somebody angry so that they're more persuadable, if there are products out there that are able to exploit the architecture of human consciousness in ways that we don't fully understand, that's a huge, huge problem. It threatens democracy. Yeah. It threatens our economy. It threatens our autonomy as human beings. And we're seeing a little bit of that right now with pricing, where you have surveillance pricing or whatever you want to call it, reacting to individual desires in ways that maximize the company's benefit at the expense of the consumer. You know, the asymmetry in information, the asymmetry in compute power makes us vulnerable. And I'm worried about the long-term implications there. So I don't know exactly what the answer is. I think transparency about what data is being gathered and how it's being used is an important step. But ultimately, it may even transcend the law. It may become an important cultural consideration as we interact with machines that know us better than we know ourselves and are able to trigger responses in us that we're not necessarily equipped to resist.
Yeah. No, absolutely. Jonathan, at the end, we have a lightning round of questions, just yes or no, one-word answers. Some of them you kind of have answered, but our social media team loves this and our audience loves these questions. So you ready?
Ready.
Okay. Should the federal government be allowed to ban state AI laws for 10 years, yes or no?
No.
Has Silicon Valley earned the benefit of the doubt on AI self-regulation?
No.
Okay, well, let's make it a little more interesting. If an AI system harms a child, should the company's CEO face personal criminal liability? Yes or no?
No. No.
Okay. And I know the answer to this one, but we'll still ask it for our audience. The EU AI Act, is it a model worth following? Yes or no?
No.
Okay, last one, which I know the answer to. Agentic AI, is it ready for the market or not ready?
Ready.
Okay, awesome. Jonathan, you really came to us today as the rare figure, you know, who has fought AI's harms in the real world, in courtrooms, coalition letters, and congressional hearings, but someone who is also willing to give companies a chance who wants innovation because of the tremendous potential these that this technology possesses. And you've shown that also that state attorney generals are not just a backup, they're the front line in this debate. And, you know, to our listeners, if you really want to understand how AI governance actually gets enforced in the United States, not through theory, not hypothesis, but enforced, remember the name Jonathan Scrimeti. Attorney General, thank you for joining the Regulating AI podcast. The work you're doing really matters, and so does this conversation. And for our listeners, this episode was brought to you in partnership with Knowledge Networks. And if this episode moved you, share it with someone in power. That's how governance changes. And until next time, keep the future responsible. Thank you, Jonathan. This was fantastic. Really enjoyed it. Very balanced and very appropriate. I had a lot more questions, but our producers, you know, want me to not be as verbose. So I'm under strict instructions from them. But you were fantastic. Thanks again.
Thank you, Sanjay.
Thanks for tuning in to the Regulating AI podcast with Sanjay Puri. If you enjoyed today's conversation, don't forget to leave a comment. We'd love to hear what you thought. Share it with someone curious about the future of AI, and join us next time for more stories and insights from the leaders shaping what's ahead. Right here on the Regulating AI podcast.